Iran voices readiness to cooperate with the UN nuclear agency to clear up false perceptions regarding its nuclear activities, but calls for impartial implementation of the IAEA. Kiev claims huge gains in its counteroffensive against Russian forces, while the Kremlin insists that it will achieve its military goals. And millions of Muslim pilgrims are heading towards the Iraqi city of Karbala ahead of Arba'in, which marks the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Iran expresses its readiness to cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency in order to clear up false accusations against its nuclear activities.
Iran is ready to cooperate with the IAEA to clear up the false and unreal images attributed to its peaceful nuclear activities. But we stress that cooperation with the IAEA is both in the sense of rights and in the sense of Iran's fundamental Islamic obligations. Just as it has obligations, it also has rights.
Foreign Ministry spokesman Anasa Kanani also called for impartial implementation of the IAEA safeguards, stressing that the agency should not yield to Israeli pressure. This after a joint statement by France, Germany, and Britain raised doubt about Iran's sincerity in seeking a nuclear agreement. The Iranian spokesman rejected the allegation, saying that the three European countries are under Israeli influence. He also described the anti-Iran statement as ill-advised and unconstructive. Kanani also said that Iran had adopted a positive approach to both the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna and the UN nuclear agency. He stressed that Tehran also expects the constructive approach by Europeans on the revival of the nuclear accord. Journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas says the IAEA treatment of Iran's nuclear work is hypocritical.
The IAEA is not really a credible organization. It's part of the money mafia. It's part of the empire, as it were, the Anglo-Zionist empire. And anything it says and does about Iran in terms of nuclear capacity, etc., is completely hypocritical. It doesn't do any of these inspections on Israel, which has over 400 nuclear weapons, allegedly, and certainly has the capability, has some. The figures vary as to what people indicate they have. But it does nothing in terms of the non-proliferation treaty. It does nothing in terms of inspections of Israel's nuclear arsenal. It doesn't even stop America beginning to nuclearize Saudi Arabia, the other major regional antagonist to Iran. So there's a huge load of hypocrisy from the alliance which is built up against Iran from having any even legal nuclear energy access.
Moving on, the Iranian Army's ground forces says its Arash-2 drone aircraft is specifically developed for strikes on Israeli cities of Haifa and Tel Aviv. The forces commander says the drone is part of a structure designed to, quote, destroy the Israeli regime. Brigadier General Kayumars Haydari says Arash-2 is a unique aircraft with precision strike capability. The general added that the ground force is now operating UAVs with strategic ranges of up to 2,000 kilometers. Arash-2 was part of the new weaponry the force tested during its military drills last week. Iran also unveiled a Babil drone, which can carry cruise missiles, earlier this month. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Palestinians will continue their struggle until they take back their rights and drive the occupiers out of their ancestral lands. The group, in a statement, also highlighted the legitimacy of Palestinian resistance against Israeli atrocities. The statement was issued on the 17th anniversary, marking the regime's expulsion from the Gaza Strip. It also condemned Israelis' cruel siege of the coastal strip and stressed that the Palestinian nation would not remain silent on the continued blockade. In 2005, Israel withdrew its forces from Gaza as it was called, a separation plan. The regime, however, imposed crippling blockades on the Strip, potentially turning it into an open prison for nearly 1 million Palestinians. Gazans have repeatedly called on the international community to push for an end to the inhumane siege. The political bureau chief of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, has paid a visit to Moscow along with several other high-ranking officials. The trip is a clear indication of growing ties between Russia and Hamas. The visit followed an invitation from Russia, which sought to discuss mutual issues, including the situation in Palestine.
Head of Hamas Political Bureau Ismail Haniyeh has visited the Russian capital Moscow to hold political talks. During his trip, he had meetings with several high-level Russian officials, including Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement has stated that Haniyeh was also accompanied by a high-ranking Hamas delegation during his Russia visit, including Deputy Hamas Chief Saleh Arouri and members of the Hamas Political Bureau. The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement also visited Russia in May 2022, where it appealed to Moscow for support in confronting Israel. So far, Russia has been vocal about its support for Palestine, and this was indicated in Haniyeh's Moscow visit 2 years ago, where he praised Moscow for defending the rights of Palestinians, and also dismissed a pro-Israel proposal, namely former US President Donald Trump's self-proclaimed so-called deal of the century. But there has been something different about the talks held between Hamas and Russia this year. The two sides had their meetings amid simmering tensions between Moscow and Tel Aviv. Relations between Russia and Israel have taken a turn for the worse since the beginning of the Russian special military operation in Ukraine. Israel blatantly expressed its opposition to the Russian move, stating that it considers the military action a violation of international law. Moscow, on the other hand, hit back, saying Israel is trying to divert attention from the Palestine-Israel conflict.
Russia, Putin just finally got it enough with Israel's playing around. Russia has a big commitment because there's a lot of Russian Jews in Israel. But at some point, they're not getting their pensions now because of the Western sanctions. And Israel's bombing in Syria constantly, and now you've got it invading Gaza, that it's beyond the pale. And then Israel turns around and votes against Russia in the UN Human Rights Council, which is just another slap in the face, the horrors that Israel perpetuates all the time and gets away with there. So, yes, this is a moment where Russia is finally going back to its roots, which was after 48, when it played with Israel. It got burnt and it went for a moral position to support the Palestinians. And that's where Russia is returning to now. So it's an exciting moment.
Palestinian groups have so far resisted Israeli deadly aggressions with Iran's blessing. It seems Russia could play an important role to end Israeli oppression of the Palestinian people in the face of international community silence. Moscow has also said that the changing global scenario provides an opportunity to change the situation of the oppressed.
Israel's hawkish stance against Russia may backfire on the regime. For starters, Russia is a UN veto-wielding member, and it can go against Israel. Furthermore, Russia's pro-Hamas stance can spread to other resistance groups, and this could translate into military support, something Israel would vehemently oppose. While Tel Aviv has been able to get away with violating Palestinian rights, now it has to worry about Hamas military action against it, and this may end up being very costly for it. Israel's remarks around the Ukraine conflict, where it slammed Russia, saying its actions are a violation of international law, have sparked anger in Moscow. In this while, Russia says Israeli mercenaries are fighting side by side with the Ukrainians against the Russians, only worsens the already simmering tensions. Relations between Moscow and Tel Aviv have also soured following Israel's continued airstrikes in Syria, despite criticism from Moscow. But could all this mean that Israel has given up on ties with Moscow and may even be looking for confrontation with Russia?
Israel is already confronting Russia. It was the reason behind a Russian plane being shot down, with Israel playing its tricks in the air, and this is a continual onslaught against Syria, against the Syrian government that Russia is supporting, and Russia is trying to stabilize Syria, get rid of ISIS. Israel is playing games there. It's trying to undermine Russia and Assad, and it's actually supporting ISIS at some points, along with the U.S. with its dirty tricks. So I really think that Russia, it's very much like the situation in Ukraine. Russia, Putin has been very low-key and very restrained in Ukraine. It could have blasted right from the start and killed tens of thousands and forced to surrender, but it didn't, because Ukrainians are almost Russians, and Putin didn't want that. But because of what the U.S. is doing and because of Zelensky, it's turned into a bloodbath. Well, that's exactly the same kind of situation that you see in Syria, and Israel is promoting the bloodbath. So let's hope that Russia against Israel, which it should have done a long time ago.
Degrading ties between Moscow and Tel Aviv have, however, sparked fresh hope for the Palestinians to become a powerful member of the international community that can upgrade its resistance against the years-long Israeli oppression, aggression, and blockades. This would also fly in the face of the U.S. side, which has staunchly supported Israel.
Moving on to the war between Moscow and Kiev, the Ukrainian army claims it has retaken 500 square kilometers of territory from Russian forces in the south of the country in the past 2 weeks. So the army says it has taken full control over several settlements in the Kherson region. Ukraine has also been claiming gains against the Russian military in the east. On Sunday, Kiev said swaths of land spanning up to 3,000 square kilometers have been recaptured since the beginning of a counteroffensive this month. Meanwhile, the Kremlin has reiterated that it will achieve its goals of a military operation that it will launch in Ukraine. Tensions with Russia and the rising energy prices are taking a toll on European economies, leaving some of them in recession, others on the brink. The UK economy grew more slowly than expected in July, raising the risk that it is already in a recession. The economy has already contracted by 1% in the second quarter. The UK inflation is at a 40-year high of more than 10%, prompting a cost-of-living crisis. The situation is not much better in Europe's biggest economy. The leading think tank has warned that Germany will fall into recession next year, as its economy is likely to shrink 0.3%. Inflation there is expected to hit above 8% this year and over 9% next year. Europe's economy is heavily reliant on Russian energy, particularly gas. Moscow has suspended gas deliveries to Europe, citing repairs and blaming the Western sanctions over the war in Ukraine. European officials say Russia is using energy as a weapon. A new report on poverty in France has revealed the devastating economic effects caused by Europe's sanctions on Russia over the war in Ukraine. Multiple indicators have reached record lows, showing that their lower classes are worse off in decades. Ramin Mazahiri reports.
The annual report from one of France's top NGOs revealed that poverty has already skyrocketed this year, And that's at what many say is only the beginning of years of inflation and recession provoked by sanctions on Russia over the unrest in Ukraine. Secours Populaire found that the number of people who say they have known poverty has increased 9% in just the past year. That's the biggest increase in 30 years. This year, over 40% of France says they can't pay their transport, medical, energy, or childcare bills, or go on vacation, or even buy fruits and vegetables. It's the highest percentage they've ever recorded.
Poverty question in France is one that's been central, but the social safety net is running out. It's just going to get worse and worse for the poor people, because they're not going to be able to afford this stuff, you know? And the French are not going to be able to subsidize these cost of living increases the way they did.
The steep increase in poverty comes after a decade of failed austerity policies and a deep devaluing of the euro currency. The government just announced they expect the next two economic quarters to produce a growth rate of 0.2% and then 0%. Many predict that the essentially recession-level economy will soon begin massive layoffs. That combination spells stagflation, and it's something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy. This adds to the feeling of unease, especially among the investor class and high finance.
France has a pretty good record of having a social safety net for those who are on bottom as far as health care is concerned and other basic necessities. But since Macron got elected, a lot of those things have changed because Macron has decided that he's going to attack that social safety net.
The report showed that a near universal 85% of France is worried for the future generations. That's also the highest percentage ever recorded. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Iraqi border officials say over 3 million pilgrims have so far entered the country for the annual commemoration of Arbaeen. Officials say the flow of pilgrims traveling to the country is smooth. Every year, millions of people, many of them from Iran, walk towards the city of Karbala, which hosts the shrine of Imam Hussein. That is to mark the 40th day since the martyrdom of the third Shia Imam. Karbala's governor says they expect over 20 million pilgrims to visit the province this year. The pilgrimage, which is one of the largest religious congregations in the world, reaches its peak on the day of Arbaeen on September 17th this year. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Economic Divide.
The weaponization of water. Turkey flexes its muscles over Syria and Iraq. Is Turkey actually doing that? Well, Syrians and Iraqis think so. More importantly, they are saying that they're suffering immensely as a result of this. But why is Turkey cutting off the water supplies from the important Euphrates and Tigris rivers? That is what we're going to try to find out in this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, the water crisis that has been ongoing for quite some time. The Euphrates and Tigris rivers are the source of the conflict. Turkey, Syria, and Iraq. What types of tensions will erupt out of that is the key question. Then, the accusation leveled against Turkey, which is using water as a weapon. Is Turkey weaponizing water? Why would it do that? Is it trying to project power? And what is the statement from Turkey a while ago where it said water for oil in terms of a swap with the Persian Gulf countries? We're going to take a close look at that. Also, the dangers of war over water, water scarcity, in which people may go and have an uprising because of their situation. Water diplomacy is the only way to go about that.
The water crisis is now a global problem, affecting not only West Asia, but also traditionally water-rich regions like Europe and West China. The crisis is mainly attributed to climate change and global warming. But when it comes to Syria and Iraq, one critical factor should be taken into account: Turkey's increasing involvement in manipulating the region's rivers and water resources. The current crisis has a long history of political geostrategic interests, alliances, and enmities. The main cause of the current mess and water dispute between Turkey and Syria stems from the crisis that prevailed after the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the emergence of modern Turkey. Back then, Ankara was told by Allied powers to consult with Iraq and Syria over the hydraulic works.
When it comes to the issue of water, we are not out to actually accuse Turkey of being guilty on this. We are exploring and we're looking at the different ways as to why Turkey has been leveled this accusation. And that is the approach that we used actually to go after online posts on this, which hopefully sheds light about what people think about this. For example, Post had this to say: Turkish fascist state continues to use water as a weapon against Syria. So that's one view, a negative view on Turkey. Next, Syrian parliament said that it had sent 57 letters to international and Arab organizations and parliaments calling them to condemn Turkey's ongoing water cutoff to Syria's Hasakah. And our final post on this issue: Turkey's southeastern Anatolia irrigation project, for example, is a series of 22 dams that diverts much of the Euphrates, and it will leave Iraq with less than 50% of the water that it historically got, says Azam Awash, who's the director of Nature of Iraq. So those were some of the views, pretty much one-sided in this case. Let's find out if our guests are in that camp or the opposite camp. All right, those were some of the online posts on this. Actually, they were quite one-sided in terms of the way they viewed Turkey. Let's find out what our guests think. Let me introduce our first guest. Erman Çetin joins us. He's an investigative journalist and a researcher who actually is the author of the article from thecradle.com titled "The Weaponization of Water: Turkey Flexes Its Muscles Over Syria and Iraq." Erman Çetin, welcome to Economic Divide. Taking a look at what Turkey is doing, and based on what you have written in your article, you've accused them of flexing its muscles over Syria and Iraq. You talk about the Euphrates, which is the source of the current and future conflicts, as you have described, between Turkey and its neighbors, and how Ankara actually wants to project its power in the region. I mean, explain to us if really Turkey is guilty of that. Because there are some who obviously reject that. Turkey obviously is one of them. And basically, has Turkey weaponized water for its political objectives? And what can those objectives be?
Yes, Turkey has rejected the allegations about its It has been using the Euphrates and Tigris rivers for decades against its neighbors such as Iraq and Syria. It claimed that if Damascus does not cut their relationship with the PKK, the Turkish government could and would cut the Euphrates River's water, so Syria will be damaged. And there has been also lots of evidence about Turkish politicians' claims about Iraqi collusion between the PKK. The real question is for Turkey. Those governments, those countries, Iraq and Syria, have been harboring the PKK, and they use the river, the water issue, as a threat against those countries.
All right, that's what the author of this article thinks, Mr. Erman Çetin. Let's bring in Aurora Sotimano. Ara Sotimano is a political scientist and a senior fellow at the Center for Syrian Studies at the School of International Relations, also a lecturer at the Faculty of Political Science, International Studies University, UNINT, who joins us from Torino, Italy. Welcome, Aurora. Turkey is accused of claiming that it is actually using water for its own benefit by controlling the waters of the Euphrates and the Tigris at the expense of Iraq and Syria. Do you agree with that? I mean, do you think that Turkey is using that to exert power, where at the same time it has also been accused of disposing industrial and municipal waste into the water? What are Turkey's gains by doing this to Syria and Iraq, do you think?
Yes. About pollution, I think that in generally speaking, pollution is a more of a sort of a technical problem. In the sense that because of the scarcity of water, low levels of water means that the concentration of chemicals, of organic waste, of whatever pollutant there is higher in the water. So I don't see Turkey purposely, you know, trying to poison water going down to Syria and Iraq. This said, of course, Turkey is using water for agricultural purposes primarily. And the use of agricultural watering means that clean water is taken from the Euphrates into the Ataturk basin and other basins, used for agriculture. And then the refluent, the flow, is taken back into the Euphrates and back into Syria, remains, which is already polluted by agricultural fertilizers and these kind of things within Turkey.
It's time now for our InfoNews section of the program. This is where we review economic news from around the world. Well, this piece of news was somewhat devastating, though it wasn't presented that way, but the outcome will be. And it's all about the Russian oil prices and how there's a cap on it now. The G7 has unveiled that plan to enforce this Russian oil price cap. Now, Russia will not sell its oil at those prices, which brings about the question, will Europe's economy take more of a beating? Well, that should be a natural outcome. Has Europe thought about that? Only time will tell. On to our next story, India's economy. Let's find out how it is. This piece of news said that it has grown by 13.5%. That's right, 13.5%. And at the same time, the news says it has missed its target. Well, the jump came because of the low base of the previous quarter. And as a result of that, economists have cautioned that there's actually going to be a slowdown. But 13.5%, that's a great increase, don't you think? All right, on to our next story. The UK is in the news these days quite a bit in terms of its economy, but it has taken a double whammy. The UK energy price cap has now tripled, and the price of gas, as a result, roughly by 266%, it has increased in the past 12 months. Add to that soaring inflation, energy costs will leave millions who are going to live without basic dignity. That's how this piece of news was actually covered. So it'll be interesting to see how this is going to pan out. I mean, without immediate government action, Basically, 12 million households will be hit by fuel poverty in the UK this winter. 42% of all households in the UK is what that translates to, or 28 million people. Our final piece of news regards the Iran JCPOA revival talks or the sanctions relief talks. And this piece of news said, no, Iranians are not negotiating from a weak economic position. In fact, it said its economy grew 4.3% last year, which then calls into question, for example, the U.S.'s hawks view that maximum pressure is beating Tehran into submission. Those were the news that we picked for you.
Listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It is time now for our in-depth section. Water is scarce in the West Asia region. Water is scarce actually around the world. Anyways, Turkey knows that, and there are question marks around how it is handling water resources when it comes to rivers like the Tigris and the Euphrates, not to mention the massive dams that it has built around the Tigris in particular. Okay, first let's take a look at what is going on. Now, the source of the problem. The Euphrates-Tigris basin is shared between Turkey, Syria and Iraq, with Iran comprising parts of the Tigris basin. But the dams that Turkey has built, it has given Turkey, as an effect, the leverage to control the water flow, meaning that it can limit the volume of water that comes flowing through these dams. Okay? So that sets the scenario. Moving on, as such, in addition to Turkey's moves there, Syria is experiencing not only climate change, which is resulting in a drought, but also because of Turkey's dam building. 5 million people are suffering. So you have that occurring, the impact of what Turkey is doing, along with climate change. Two of Syria's dams are facing closures, which are responsible for generating electricity for 3 million people. Next up, we move on to Iraq. Iraq, as a result of what Turkey is doing, is not in good shape either. Actually, the drought there, again, as a result of climate change, along with Turkey's move, has impacted 7 million Iraqis. They are suffering as a result. So combine that with Syria, you have 12 million people whose lives are at risk. Next, some of the areas which has been affected in terms of the sectors include the following: farmland, obviously agriculture, fisheries, power production, and of course, drinking water. Now, how can people survive in these conditions? Now, meanwhile, Turkey is sitting pretty well when it comes to its water resources. When it comes to percent originating from within its borders, it's 98%, but outside of its borders, in terms of the water, it only is in need of 1.5%. Now, by comparison, take a look at Syria. Originating outside of its borders for water that it needs, it's 72% reliant, while within it's 28%. And our last graph is Iraq, where you have 61% originating outside of its borders, while 39% Iraq relies on inside its border. All right, let's get a breakdown. Rejoining us is Armen Çeta, the investigative journalist and researcher, whom we told you is the author of the article from thecradle.com, Weaponization of Water. Armen, welcome back. When we take a look at what Turkey has done in terms of its intentions, there are geopolitical goals that obviously it has in mind. One of them is weakening the Syrian government in this case. What do you think is going on there, especially in comparison or in the same context of Israel, who is after weakening the Syrian government when it comes to, for example, water?
The Israeli government also supports the instabilization of Syria. It has invaded it in 1967, and it also annexed some part of Golan Heights. So also the Syrian people cannot use and cannot claim its sovereignty on the natural resources of the Golan Heights. And the Golan Heights is very rich with respect to natural resources. So what Israel wants or has been wanted for decades on Syria is also, or not just Syria, the whole Arab land, the whole Palestine, is to claim its occupation on the Arabs' natural resources. So it's a part of Zionist strategy to weaken the Arab governments, the Arab countries, and Syria is one of the most respected supporters of the resistance against Zionist occupation.
All right, let's find out what Aurora Sati Mano thinks. She's the political scientist and senior fellow at the Center for Syrian Studies who rejoins us. Aurora, welcome back. Taking a look at Turkey, we have talked about how it is flexing its muscles, so to speak, when it comes to the way that it's using water as a weapon, as many have accused Turkey of doing. Is that the case? How is it affecting countries like Iraq and Syria, for example, which in this case in point are suffering as a result of water shortages? Is it only because of Turkey and what it's doing vis-a-vis the dams that it has constructed, for example?
Yes, definitely I would say that water is the source of conflict now, and it will be in the future, maybe even more. It has been in the past. So Turkey has tried to impose its will over hostile groups in northern Syria by, you know, manipulating water. And Turkey is also using its control of water to put pressure on the Assad government in order to accede to this vision, to Erdogan's vision of northern Syria. But to answer more properly, we should take a step back and look at historically. In the past, water policies have been always enmeshed with other political confrontations. From the 70s, basically, from the beginning of the GAP, the Great Anatolian Project, which consisted of, I think, 21 dams on the Euphrates and one on the Tigris. So since the 70s and during the 80s and 90s, links between water negotiation and politics, higher politics, regional relations, have been unmistakable.
Turkey has rejected the claim that it's using water as a weapon, and it says that it's working with Syria, Iraq, and Iran for the fair distribution of water resources. However, evidence suggests otherwise. A 2002 fact-finding mission said that Turkey was providing 300 cubic meter per second from Jarablus River instead of 500 cubic meters that was originally agreed upon. It is now predicted that the West Asia region is likely to witness more water-related crises in the near future. And Turkey's ambitious plans to monopolize water resources will give it a strategic weapon against its rivals and neighbors.
The issue of water in any part of the world is crucial for survival, but in the West Asia region, it is a matter of life and death. Turkey knows this, and the verdict is out on whether it is using it as a political tool or not. Many have concluded that it is. Turkey's position on the Euphrates and the Tigris is that these rivers are transboundary, means that they are rivers that cross at least one political border. Therefore, Ankara sees the two rivers as a uniform basin and part of its sovereignty. Iraq and Syria, however, see the rivers as international and separate entities. It's no surprise that this difference in the point of views needed a mediator to solve the conflict. This happened in 1980. After a joint security agreement with Syria, Turkey said any commitment by Turkey would be conditional to Syria's loyalty to the agreement. But then things hit a snag when Turkey threatened Damascus with severing its access to the Euphrates. The reason? Turkey's perceived notion of Damascus' support for PKK, which Ankara views as a terrorist organization. Turkey issued a statement soon after saying that Turkey's resources are Turkey's. The oil resources are theirs. We do not say we share their oil resources, and they cannot say they share our water resources. To make matters worse, Turkey was accused of environmental damage when it decided to take things a step further in this dispute. Turkey was accused of dumping industrial and municipal waste into rivers, hurting Iraqis and Syrians as a result, hurting things like irrigation use. Last but not least, there may be another reason why Turkey is keen on using water resources as a political tool against Syria. For that to be understood, we need to go as far back as the year 2004. Israel and Turkey signed an agreement whereby Turkey would sell water off the Manavgat River to Israel. The sale of Turkish water to Israel, however, failed. The recent improvement in diplomatic ties between Israel and Turkey gives rise to the possibility that since their interests converge in Syria, there may be reason for both wanting to keep the Syrian government weak. There's no credible evidence, however, to prove this theory. That does it for this segment of the program.
This is the situation when it comes to this water conflict. In West Asia, the water conflict has occurred when downstream countries are weak and unable to adapt to water scarcity, and where the relative strength is extremely low at this point for them to retain the water. The only solution that exists is for diplomacy to prevail. Some call it water diplomacy, which would involve Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. Turkey once had the motto, zero problems with neighbors. It's time that it acts on that regarding this issue. That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for being with us. From Mikhail Tagway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
The ocean of dua.
Why did you leave us to fend for ourselves? Hussein, Hussein, the slain.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Madarisi, and in this edition of The Ocean of Dua, we are trying to discuss and talk about the different aspects of زيارة إمام الحسين عليه السلام زيارة العاشوراء. So stay with us.
ولعن الله آل زياد وآل مروان ولعن الله بني أمية قاطبة ولعن الله ابن مرجان ولعن الله عمر بن سعد ولعن الله شمرا.
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing this excerpt of زيارة العاشوراء. ولعن الله آل زياد وآل مروان. May Allah distance from His mercy the clan of Ziyad and the clan of Marwan. وَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ بَنِي أُمَيَّةَ قَاطِبَةَ. May Allah distance from His mercy the progeny of Umayyah altogether. In the previous episodes, we discussed the true meaning of La'an. Also, we had a look at what history tells us about Ziyad and Marwan. And now we were discussing Bani Umayyah. We said Umayyah is the musaghar form of the word Amma, which means a slave girl. Now, about who Umayyah was. History tells us that Umayyah was a Roman slave bought by someone named Abd al-Shams, which was the son of Abd Manaf. Thereafter, he saw some intelligence and astuteness in this Abd, in this Roman slave. So it is said that he adopted him as his own child. And after that, he was attributed in the society to Abd al-Shams as his own son, although he was not his biological son. Anyway, although some of the members of the progeny of Umayyah later claimed to hail from Quraysh, their origin is not at all related to Quraysh. Imam Ali alayhi salam, in one of the letters to Muawiyah, who claimed to be from the progeny of Abd Manaf, says, أَمَّا قَوْلُكَ إِنَّا بَنُو عَبْدِ مَنَافِ فَكَذَلِكَ نَحْنُ وَلَكِنْ لَيْسَ أُمَيَّتُكَ هَاشِمٌ. As for your claim that you say we are the sons of Abd Manaf, you should know that we likewise are the same, but Umayyah is not like Hashim. And Imam continues, وَلَا حَرْبْ كَعَبْدِ الْمُطَّلِبِ. And Harb is not like Abd Muttalib. وَلَا أَبُو سُفْيَانْ كَأَبِي طَالِبْ وَلَا الْمُهَاجِرُ كَالطَّلِيقِ وَلَا الصَّرِيحُ كَاللَّصِيقِ. Nor is Abu Sufyan like Abu Talib, nor is an emigrant like one who was taken as captive and then released for compensation. Nor is a proper blood relationship like one who is attached to a relationship, which is called lasiq. Now, what does Imam Ali alayhi salam truly mean by these words? In order to properly understand what Imam alayhi salam meant in this letter, let us have a look at the definitions of some of the words used. For example, about the words taliq and lasiq, in one of the commentaries we read, taliq is the one who was taken as captive and then released through great favor or compensation. Abu Sufyan and Muawiyah were from tulaqa. They were from the captives who were released on great favor or compensation on the day of victory of Mecca. And a muhajir, or emigrant, is the one who embraced belief whilst in fear and migrated to be emancipated from fear. And sarih is the one with proper lineage, whereas lasiq is the one who is associated to them, although he is alienated from them.
When people ask, I'm confused about which school is right or which madhab is right, go to Karbala. Look at Karbala, it clarifies it instantaneously. Anybody says, I'm confused, say, please go to Karbala and tell me what happened, why it happened, and what does it have to do with your religion. You will see it completely exemplifies. It clarifies, it takes all the blurs out instantaneously. SubhanAllah, that's the miracle of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam's main foundation of morality is, do not allow tyranny. Do not allow evil doing. Do not allow indecency. Why is Imam like this? Because he knows Allah. He appreciates Him. He understands His dimensions. That's why we must love them so much. We must love them so much that don't let anybody else take us away from them. There should be no room in our thoughts. No matter who we admire in this world, no matter how great a person we look at, never move the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt out of the center of the heart. Never. They will know that their Khalifa lied to them because he told them they don't pray.
And if they see them praying on the battlefield, their hearts will change. So stop them from praying. Imagine how evil these people were. That's how much lies they had. And you cannot eradicate this lie at the level that we're talking about unless you give your blood for the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Now, in order to understand more of Umayyah and his progeny, let us have a look at what Allama Majlisi in his Bihar al-Anwar writes. With regard to the origin of Umayyah, he writes, قال صاحب الكامل البهائي إن أمية كان غلاما روميا لعبد شمس فلما ألقاه كيسا فطنا أعتقه وتبناه فقيل أمية bin Abd al-Shams. He says, indeed, Umayyah was a Roman slave of Abd al-Shams. Then he found him to be astute. He found some cleverness in him. So he freed him, and then he adopted him as his son. And then it was said to him, Umayyah ibn Abd al-Shams. According to another narration, Bani Umayyah are not from Quraysh. Rather, Abd al-Shams Ibn Abdul Manaf had a Roman slave called Umayyah, and therefore he was attributed to him. So it was said Umayyah ibn Abdul Shams, and that is why they attributed Banu Umayyah to Quraysh. However, their origin was Rome, and to attach a person like that to one's lineage was permitted among the Arabs. So that is why he came to be known as one who is related to Quraysh. This is what history tells us in different narrations. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
أنت الذي صنعت من الرمح منبرا ظمآن والزمان بعينيك ممطرا نعم الأمير أنت حسين وقدوتي ساروا إليك قلبي وعقلي ودمعتي يا محيي الكرامة تبكيك كل عين لبيك يا إمامي لبيك يا حسين بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.